Hi Louise,
Hi, Chris.
how are you?
I'm really good, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
No, it's really nice to have you on. Thank you. Thanks so much. So we've been talking for a little while about doing this, and it's kind of finally come to it. And it's crazy because January just seemed to drag for a long time, and yeah, here we are already kind of pretty much in March, and it's I think you and I were initially talking before Christmas, so it's somehow come around really quickly. But yeah,
Yeah,
good
I
to see
know.
you,
Yeah,
Louise.
what happened to February? I feel the same way.
Yeah, but look, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to the Employer Bland podcast. So for anybody that doesn't know, a lot of people watching this and listening to this podcast will already know who you are, but for anyone out there that doesn't, Louise Archer, founder of Retrain Search. And for anybody that doesn't know, Retrain Search teach recruiters and recruitment business owners how to secure and deliver projects on a retained search basis. That's the kind of premise. Is that a fair kind of introduction of
Yeah,
Retrain, Louise?
that's exactly it. Yeah, very much so.
Good stuff. So before we kick off into our main conversation, Louise, it'd be really nice if you could give us a little bit of background on you. And I suppose the person behind the mask of LinkedIn, that's often how I put it, because in these sort of networks, we seem to know each other, but very much from that, the kind of facade of LinkedIn and not much beyond it. But would you be able to give us a little bit, a bit of insight to you, who you are, where you've come from, grew up, maybe early influences in life and business and that type of thing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think one of the nice things about LinkedIn nowadays is that you do see a little bit of a glimpse kind of behind the curtain, and people are more confident now at sharing some of them, the more personal aspects of their life. And I try to do that periodically too. I am a recruiter. I'm a recruiter. I'm not a trainer. I wasn't born a trainer or haven't grown up in that world. My mum had a recruitment business, so I was filing CVs in summer holidays at 12, 13 years old, and sitting candidates down in the front room when they turn up in the evening for interviews. And then eventually, my first job was candidate controller with my mum's secretarial recruitment firm. A controller. So it's not a great job description, is it? But it was a great job, and I loved it, and it was a lot of fun. And I've done lots of other things since then, but kind of come back into recruitment in when I settled down from my worldly travels. And I guess became quite good at it, really. I was a contingent recruiter for a very long time, and I didn't actually know there was really anything else other than that. That was the only thing I knew. And it wasn't until I started to work for more sophisticated firms, a Hudson was one of them, was formerly trained there, very good business, that I started to see that side of the industry that I didn't know existed before, of retained and executive and more complex work. But I didn't think it was an area I was ever going to inhabit. And then it wasn't until much later in my career, I was working for Air Swift and met a guy there called Matt Howell, who was much more experienced than I. And we were tasked for various different reasons with a project called Most Money Soonest, which is a nice project name. But basically, it was to shore up the permanent side of the business. The revenue forecasts were unpredictable, and his initiative was to shore that up on a retained basis, which he'd done a little bit of before. And we kind of joined forces and had a go at that, and it worked. It worked really well. Worked phenomenally well. In fact, that business was about to be, written off basically by the investment firm that was taking it through the transaction because it was so poor. The not in terms of revenue, but the forecast stability of it was so unpredictable. And then shoring it up on a retained basis, they do about $12 million a year now in retained revenue, and it worked really well. So that was where kind of the big light bulb moment came for me, and it's just been going from strength to strength really, in terms of knowledge and learning. And I think when you've got a growth mindset and you just want to know more, then you never really stop, do you? You're just learning all the time.
Was it quite a daunting shift initially, Louise, from that?
Do you remember that time? Yeah, very much so.
Across to, because I, you know, in a previous life worked in agency. I never made the leap to exec search. It always seemed like it was this like utopia world that was a little bit inaccessible. There'd be the odd project that you'd hear about. It's like, oh, I got this on a, you know, people would call it a retained basis because there was some fee up front, but there was nothing else really in it. It was a complete one-off. It was, you know, just stumbled lucky. But yeah, I've always been really interested with, you know, that shift from contingency across. Did you vividly remember what that was like?
I do, because I was frightened by even explaining that this is how it was going to work and this was what the solution was going to look like to the client. And I had Matt with me and he was much more confident and, you know, able than me, and he was supporting me all the way through it. And we came out and went, oh my God, and we'd won like four really senior positions on a retained basis with like a £40,000 retainer paid on commencement of work. And neither of us could quite believe it, but it just went from strength to strength. And I think one of the biggest things that I realized was it doesn't need to be senior though since then. And after that, a lot of the work that we converted from contingent was mid-level work. It wasn't particularly senior, and I started to get less and less daunted by it as time went on, as you do. But it just so happened that the first piece of work that I won was senior and was a big piece of work, but a lot of it isn't. It isn't any more senior than the work that I was working on previous.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's more of a, and again, this is more of an assumption, but does it become a bit of a mindset shift in like, I'm not really prepared to allow myself to become too invested in something without there being a level of commitment from both sides?
I mean, that's where you get to. That's where you get to with it, definitely. And when you speak to most experienced search consultants and say, well, how do you, when you work on a retained basis, they say, well, I wouldn't work in any other way, you know? Yeah. And that's great for them because, well, that's where they are. And that's where I got to with it too. But that's not helpful for people that are making the transition because, with the best will in the world, we got trained on how to sell retained search. And this guy came in and said, you just value your time and you just tell them this is the way you're working. Didn't work for me. That did not work for me. It didn't work for anybody else in that room either. And what I've discovered, actually, there's a step between those two things of yes, it's a mindset shift, but it's to look at it as a solution to the problem that the contingent model isn't solving. And that's what worked for me. Mm-hmm. So what we did was to look at all the contingent positions that the business were working on and how many we were actually filling. So we were solving about 20% of them, 15 to 20% across the perm business. So if every 10 jobs worked, we were filling, you know, two of them, say.
Yeah.
Which is about average. That's about right on a contingent basis. But what we needed to do was to convert the rest of them into revenue. Yep. We didn't want to be working on stuff that we needed to increase that. So for all the ones that we weren't getting a fee from, we were looking at, well, what's going wrong? Why aren't we getting a fee from it? And it was either because a lot of it was because we didn't have the commitment from the client and they were touting out to other agencies, or they weren't coming back to us quickly enough on resumes and we were losing candidates and all those things that happen when you're working on that basis, right? So what we worked out was if we could secure that on a retained basis, we can actually fill twice the amount and double our revenue by not actually making any massive transformational change or increasing resources or doing anything else. So basically, that's what we did. And I started to see it as, if the contingent model's working well, brilliant, carry on doing that. From a client perspective, I mean. But if it isn't, here's what we'll do. And this is what we'll do. And this will mean that we'll reach a result on a 95% basis.
Yeah.
And will you let me have the opportunity to show you that? And so it isn't necessarily that it's senior, it's that the commitment allows you to put in place a better process, a more robust process that means that you can make sure you reach your result, which is of course what you want and what the client wants.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's probably a really nice segue into the main topic for today. And something I was really keen to discuss, and I'm really glad that, you know, grateful that you kind of agreed to the topic and wanted to talk about it. But you know, what I've noticed, and certainly probably more so in the last couple of years, more than you know any of the years prior to that, in my experience, is that there seems to be a very strong relationship now between executive search and employer branding.
Yeah.
I find it a really interesting relationship because the exec search consultants and the firms, they don't own the employer brand. It's not their employer brand. They're kind of, they almost become like the custodian for that particular search or set of searches of an employer brand. But there's a huge responsibility to like take that employer brand, communicate it to pools of talent to try and, I suppose, engage the right people. Certainly in my experience in contingency recruitment was that, you know, on any one particular project, there could be upwards of like, you know, certainly in the early days, you know, 3, 4, 5 agencies, maybe more working on one vacancy or a series of vacancies. There's a huge scramble to get out to market. The communication, the messaging is all over the place. Like it's very difficult. I think that we both know in those scenarios to deliver at any level of quality, whether it's communicating an employer brand or even knowing what the employer brand is and delivering any level of quality. So I just really wanted to talk to you at the top of the, you know, conversation really, Louise, about that relationship between executive search and employer branding, and I suppose the importance of getting that right.
Yeah, it's huge. You know, the responsibility as a search consultant is to put the client in the position that they are making their decision from all of the options available to them in the market at this time.
Yeah.
And therefore, it is your responsibility to bring all of the possible talent to the table. And without the strength of clarity of message and purpose around the employer brand, then you're just not going to be able to do that. So it's integral to the whole project every time, every single time. Mm-hmm. And why we spend a significant amount of time exploring what that message is in the briefing meeting and adjusting it if necessary, you know, throughout the process of the search as we bring in insight and feedback and intelligence from the actual search itself, which can often or can mean that, you know, a re-steer. But certainly in the first instance, getting the clarity of the message, it can mean the difference between taking on a project or not.
Yeah.
Or taking the project on at the right time and sometimes pausing, making sure that we have got clarity of that message before we go to market. You only get one chance with a talent pool.
Yeah.
And you can't kind of go back and say, actually, you know how I told you this was their vision and their purpose and their mission? Well, actually, it isn't, because that didn't appeal to you, so I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
So you've got to get it as good as you possibly can first time. And that's not always easy. And for that reason, the big firms that are really good at this, you know, your Microsofts and your top of each field, your GSKs in life sciences, you know, they actively commission perception studies on a regular basis to collect the perception of their employer brand, because it's one thing conveying an employer brand and it's another thing receiving it. And the perception of that is actually the reality, regardless of what you intend it to be. Mm. And that's helpful for them, because that can mean that they're constantly adjusting their employer brand. And so as a search consultant, I've always seen myself as a small part in that bigger process. And each time I'm going to market for a client, I'm taking the clearest and most compelling message that I can, but at the same time, I'm collecting perception information and feedback from, so that feeds back into the employer brand so we can adjust it continuously. Yeah. And so each time, I like to think that each time my clients are going to market, they're going to market stronger and stronger each time, because they're appealing more to the talent pools that they want to appeal to using the information that they get from each project.
Yeah, I really like that. And I didn't really think of that aspect of you know, gathering the perception data, the feedback from candidates. That, like, that must actually be so important. Like, if you want to go on a bit of a longer term journey, and I suppose a journey that includes evolution, you know, we want things to get better. Search after search after search, the idea is that we get better and better and better.
Yeah.
That is super important, isn't it? And I'd imagine, you know, one of the beauties of exec search is that once you kick off, not so much, I was going to say you can sort of sit back and take a breather. I don't mean that from a, you know, you can get lazy and not take time, but you can actually, instead of thinking, right, we need this mad rush out to market as quickly as we possibly can, you can actually begin to get your ducks in a row, I'd imagine, can't you, with this important foundational stuff to make sure, and again, this is an assumption, but just to make sure that what you actually want to take to market and communicate is exactly where it needs to be. For that, you know, for the reasons you said earlier, to make a first impression.
Yeah, and several times I've carried out that particular exercise first before going to market and collecting information like not just what's your perception of my client in the market, but also who are the employers of choice in this market for you? And not just who are they, but why are they the employers of choice for you? Yeah. And then we can take that information and then build the employer brand that we know is appealing to them, and put the messaging together and then go back to market and start to attract people.
Yeah. And I'd imagine as well, doing that piece of competitor analysis around employer branding, you can actually start to figure out where your customer is unique and, you know, what is unique about the employer brand and I suppose elements of the EVP for your particular customer. So when you take a message to market, you know, that element of being able to stand out from the crowd, it's, you know, that becomes a little bit more straightforward, I suppose, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, on a wider scale, but particularly for me as a search consultant, there's only so much I can do. I can't impact the brand globally across their clients and their all of their target talent pools. But what I can do is have an impact on the mission that I'm there to serve, which might be to become more appealing to diverse candidates or to a specific niche skill set that they're struggling to attract.
Yeah.
And that's my contribution to the overall brand, and in order to do that, I'd rather not guess at what I think might be appealing to them. And so if there isn't any data that exists that tells us this is what this talent pool wants to hear, this is what they want from their careers, this is why they want to work for the employers of choice in the business, if we don't know anything about that, I'd rather find some of that out before we go taking a message to market.
That makes perfect sense. And there's another thing, you know, with that relationship between exec search and employer branding, like, I think it's so easy to, you know, to look at an organization, particularly kind of, you know, when you start looking at larger organizations, enterprise businesses, global businesses across, you know, tons of different regions, you know, the employer brand can look like this enormous thing. And there's so much to get your head around and so many different kind of, you know, individual pillars to it. But when you're looking at retain searches, is it fair to say that, you know, quite often you can kind of just dive into very specific parts of an organization? You know, what does the micro employer brand look like for that one very specific part of an organization, and how can you start to extract elements from that part of the business that you're actually working with and delivering for?
I mean, for sure, you can carve out, you know, business units, you can carve out purposes, project teams within a bigger business, and therefore kind of separate the perception and convey the vision and the mission and the purpose of a, or even specific leaders within a business. And that's massively helpful. It can be especially helpful in situations where the main business employer brand isn't that strong. Actually the business unit or the leader, a particular unit from a particular part of the industry, is more compelling than the overall company proposition, for example. But the reverse is also true, that being able to target specific talent pools and convey a specific message to them is also possible. You know, for example, I remember when I was with one of the firms, a very reputable firms, great professional research firm, who do a lot of this work. There was a project for one of the banks, traditional bank, Again, very well established, very well-known brand. And they were building a mobile app for the first time. And they needed to build a mobile app development team. And the problem they were having was it's a bank. And it's a financial services organization with a financial services culture, setup, process, policy, leadership team. And they were looking to bring in a tech, young, not, you know, very different demographic, culture, mindset, wants, needs, desires. And it was a real challenge. And they were really struggling with it because they didn't want to work in this kind of banking environment. And what you're able to do on a micro basis, as you say, with the right messaging, is to be able to find out and get under the skin of what these people want and need from their careers, and then convey a message to them that appeals to them specifically that might not be what the whole company wants to convey on a wider scale.
Yeah.
But it's helpful if you're looking at targeting specific talent pools.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that, you know, I'd imagine storytelling, you know, in whichever kind of capacity or medium you're able to storytell, because I suppose from project to project is different, what you've got access to, who you've got access to, you know, the level of transparency you're able to get access to and that kind of stuff. But you are effectively kind of being trusted to tell somebody's or an organization's, you know, story. And I'd imagine there are kind of do's and don'ts in that capacity sometimes. One thing I was thinking of is, you know, with a lot of organizations, I'd imagine, and particular searches that somebody could be working on at one moment in time, you know, the successful candidate or applicant could be going into quite a challenging environment. It's not always, you know, rainbows and butterflies and brilliance. And I think with a lot of employer brands and the messaging that is delivered into the market quite often, it is often rainbows and butterflies, all of it. But actually, when you go through the doors, it's like it's still potentially an amazing place to be. But there are some massive challenges ahead. You know, there's some massive issues that they're tackling, some real uphill struggles, which, let's face it, a lot of people love that stuff. They want to get their teeth stuck into that stuff because that's, for a lot of people, that's the most exciting stuff that, you know, will get them out of bed in the morning. But, you know, what in regards to the do's and don'ts with storytelling, you know, do you think, are you a big advocate of kind of the good, the bad, the ugly, you know, just understand it all, and then once you've got it all, you can actually start figuring out, okay, how do we start telling these stories in the right capacity?
Yeah, I think there's a few cases in which I've been involved with work like that. And I mean, to an extent, it's prevalent in some way, shape or form in every project. I remember looking at the BP account with one of the firms I was working with, and it was immediately after the Macondo disaster in 2010. And BP were in crisis following not just the millions and millions and billions that it took to clean it up, but the reputation and the damage that it did to their brand in the aftermath, and the problem that they had with talent for a long, 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 long time. I mean, Air Swift were lucky enough to be tasked with a project that looked to reset the perception of their business following that disaster. And that was a really good example of taking an awful situation and being able to convey a message that was purposeful and meaningful, because it was the biggest lesson they'd ever learned.
Yeah.
You know, and they do a thing at the end of every project called Lessons Learned in oil and gas. And that was the biggest lesson they'd ever learned. And what it meant was that transformational change had to happen. And what I'd like to think that Swift were able to do in the aftermath of that, was Air Energy then, was to be able to have those targeted conversations with key, very highly experienced talent, and to explain what was being done to change the organization and invite them to be a part of it. And And it, so it's incredible the storytelling that you can do, not just on a wider scale, but on, you know, an individual basis when you're the custodian of a brand, of someone else's story.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I suppose for a lot of people looking, you know, the candidates that you, or people that you'd engage with in those searches, you know, although it is a terrible scenario, terrible situation, you know, framed in the correct way and communicated in the right way, it is actually like you can turn that into a positive, can't you? Because it is absolutely an amazing, for the right people that are delivering this message and this story, and, you know, in a way that it, the passion and the, you know, and everything else that kind of surrounds that, how passionate they are about change and actually making this good. Like, for a lot of people, that's a real positive thing, isn't it? And that's something they really want to get involved with. So, yeah, that's interesting. So to kind of round things off, we were going to talk a little bit about, you know, how to extract the information and content needed to represent an organization's employer brand effectively. And the reason I wanted to talk about this, Louise, is that in my own experience, you know, engaging with organizations of all sorts of shapes and sizes on employer brand and EVP related projects, is that I've been so surprised, certainly through the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, that how many organizations, even at like mid enterprise level, they seem to have a real lack of content. They've got a lack of messaging. A lot of them haven't got any, you know, an EVP in place. You know, there's a lack of kind of collateral to be able to get hold of that's kind of tangible and that you can weave into stories and take to market. So I was quite interested to understand, you know, if you're in a situation where you are a bit thin on the ground with, you know, employer brand material, recruitment marketing material, you know, you're just thin on the ground with stuff that you can get hold of and take to market, are there any kind of quick wins or things that you can do to rustle stuff up? You know, is there activity that can be done to actually just get something together that will make this search more compelling, and we'll be able to, you know, conjure up something that can be taken to market?
Yeah, good question. So starting at the beginning of that question, I'm always keen to dive into the EVP in the briefing session when I'm starting a project, and getting under the skin of where the business has come from, where it is at the moment, where it's going, and getting that story, the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? And it's almost nice, people like, you know, flourish through adversity, and, you know, they like a story. So it's nice to have that. I like to get under the skin of what projects, what initiatives, anything unusual I like. I've recently been getting under the skin of social purpose and understanding that, and the things that people do there is phenomenal. And but one of the things that Mitch Sullivan always talks about, so much time and respect for Mitch, he always says, like, the key question that you want to be asking at that stage is why somebody is very happy in the job they're doing. They have a purpose in their work. They are well looked after. They're extremely well rewarded financially, and they get satisfaction from their job. Why would they leave that to come and work for you? Mm-hmm. And then just let them talk, and that's like the real meat that you get as to, like, why would somebody upheave their whole career to come and actually work for you? What's that reason? And why did they work for the company? Why did they leave something that they were probably perfectly happy in to come here? Mm. And then I like having something tangible to take to market, you know, telling a story. And I'm a massive advocate of this, as you probably know, Chris, in every stage of your interaction with clients, through the sales process or with candidates, as you're presenting an opportunity to them, visuals make such a massive difference. Such a massive difference. You know, it's scientific fact that visuals remain in the mind 75% longer than the spoken word. So whatever it is that you conjure together, conjure something together. videos, even little videos over Zoom, like this, you interviewing the CEO and asking him or her to tell their story, interviewing other people that are part of the team to find out why they've joined and how it's fulfilling them, and putting something that looks nice visually together. And I will say this because it's true, but I always recommend the Voice Digital job description, candidate briefing packs. Because I think they're brilliant, and everyone that asks me that question, I always give them the same answer. It's nice, it's really nicely laid out, it's easy to put together. You guys do a great job of doing what needs to be done, but you know, you don't need to make it overcomplicated or overly expensive or overly, you know, it's not a sledgehammer with a wall. It's just the right amount for the right purpose at the right time.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. And can you confirm I didn't pay you to say that?
No, you did not. We did not discuss that. You did not know that that's what I was going to say. I'm saying it because it's true.
No, thank you very much. And on that note as well, something I've seen a real shift, you know, in that exact same vein, Louise, in the last, you know, probably like 18 months, where I think, you know, slightly larger organizations that have got a little bit more red tape around marketing and employer brand used to have these big guardrails up of like, look, no videos, you know, no, we don't want anybody taking, but they seem to have dropped a little bit now, and actually being able to gain access to a, you know, to a senior leader that you're working on a search with that is able to jump on a call like this and create a short video where they talk about the purpose, talk about the challenges, but why the challenges are really exciting for the right person. The guardrail seems to have, I don't know if you've experienced it in the companies that you work with, but
absolutely.
Asking the question, there are a lot more yeses being given out than nos these days for that, and it makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it massively does. Like being able to hear it from direct from, you know, the horse's mouth, as it were, there's just no substitute for that. You know, you as a consultant can represent them in the best possible way and give a clarity of message, but there's nothing quite like hearing it and seeing that in the flesh for a prospective candidate joining the business. So I'll always encourage them to do as much of that as possible. Even if it is just as primitive as just doing this, you know, doing it for a few minutes. And that's what I'll say, make it easy for them. It won't take long. It'll just be a 10-minute conversation over Zoom. That's all we need. You know, if you start, sometimes if you talk about doing it professionally and sending a film crew in, they can get a bit, you know, they're not quite sure whether they're ready for that. But a 10-minute chat over Zoom might just be manageable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Louise, been really, really nice catching up. It always is. Thank you so much for taking the time out. We always round off with one very final quick thing. But if you were able to give two pieces of small advice to anybody on how to avoid being employer bland, what would they be?
I mean, it's got to be that. That question, and I know it's not mine, it's Mitch Sullivan's, so thank you, Mitch. It's got to be, what would you say to someone that is really happy with their life, their career, their job, their family situation, their personal circumstances, their commute, everything? They're really, really happy. What would you say to that person? Why should they come and work for you? How to stop being bland.
I really like that. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that again, actually, because when you said it for the first time, I kind of grabbed hold of that virtually. I like it. I'm going to use that myself. But Louise, thank you so much. It's been lovely catching up. I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Chris. Nice to see you.
Take care. Bye.